Hi, I'm Josh Rushing, sitting in for Femi OK, and you're in the stream. Today, is democracy in El Salvador at risk? The country is making international headlines as the world's first to declare Bitcoin a legal tender. But critics of the president and his government say they're undermining checks and balances in a grab for continued power. Now, as always, we want to hear your thoughts, your questions right there in the YouTube live chat. Join me for today's conversation. All right, joining us today, we have Jose Marinero. He is the president at the Foundation for Democracy, Transparency, and Justice. He is in San Salvador. Paul Steiner serves the Salvadoran government as the president of the National Commission for Small and Micro Companies. He's also in San Salvador. And completing our lineup is John Holman in Mexico City, Al Jazeera's longtime correspondent covering Latin America. He actually reported from El Salvador and showed us how life has changed there recently. Let's see some of his report.
You can feel the difference in the streets of Las Palmas, a tough neighborhood in the capital, says Julio Cesar. He should know, he earns a living on these streets painting murals.
We're living calmly now, without problems. You can go and get a soda or a beer, wherever around here.
Before it wasn't like that then.
Before it wasn't like that. You wouldn't see a light in the street after 7 p.m. There's a lot of police here right now, and that didn't exist before.
But extortion's still rife, and it was obvious as we visited that the gangs were present, even if they're at peace.
It's a great report, John, and a lot of the changes that are happening in El Salvador, and I have some stats to bring up later in the show to show how murder rates are down and violence is down, but a lot of the changes people are crediting president, the new president elected in 2019, President Bukele. Can you tell me, who is he? What's so interesting about him?
Yeah, it was really interesting to be there, actually. And he is a really interesting person, character at the moment in Central America. He's a young president. He's really good on Twitter. He's really good on social media and marketing. And you just actually mentioned the Bitcoin sort of initiative. And I think that's all part of that. He's also seen, I think, by a lot of Salvadorans as someone who can get things done. The country's had 30 years of sort of dueling parties, in which there's been a lot of political gridlock and also a lot of institutional corruption. And he's basically said, I'm going to cut through all of that. I'm going to make things happen. So on the success side of the ledger for him, he seemed to handle the pandemic quite well. The vaccination campaign in El Salvador went well. And also what you saw in the report there in terms of violence in the country, this country's just been dogged by gang warfare for so long, and he has managed to reduce that violence. Now, there have been reports by very creditable media that he's done that by doing a truce between gangs, which is something he said he wouldn't do, and something that other governments in the past have done. So it's debatable how he's done that, but has he reduced violence? His government has reduced violence in the country. And I think that accounts for his high popularity rate. This is a popular president right now in El Salvador. So that's all on the good side of the ledger. Now we go a bit to the other side of the ledger, which is the fact that the president in his time of office, in the time that we went, he just, his Supreme Court that his Congress had just elected had said that the president of the country could run again for re-election if he wanted to. To put this into perspective, he'd be the first president, if he chose to do that and did run for re-election and won, in 70 years, and the last one that did it was a military dictator. So that is something that's a big deal in El Salvador right now. He's done other things like replace the Supreme Court justices. He's just moved to forcibly retire through his party a third of the country's judges. And those are moves that he says he needs to do to clean house. That's what he's called it. Now, obviously, if you're looking at that, if you're a journalist, or you're a free speech organization, you're thinking, I've seen this before in Latin America. Where is this all going from this president? So it's a really interesting moment in the country with President Bukele and those sorts of almost two or three sides to him.
Thank you so much. And Jose, from your perspective, what do you see there?
Well, I agree that this facet of President Bukele has attractive, I guess, garnered international attention. He projects this anti-establishment image. He wears jeans and his baseball cap backwards, even to formal occasions.
Wait, is that a good thing?
This is the image he projects, right? It looks, makes him look modern and connected with the youth. But he's actually a late millennial. He's 40 years old right now. He has a fixation, I guess, with his own image. He is very good in Twitter. Yes, he's very social media savvy. He is known for having, for example, he fired public servants via Twitter a few months ago. But he also has a large following of internet trolls and bullies. He's definitely an effective communicator of, I would qualify, of a usually shallow discourse. He's highly intolerant with critics, particularly with independent media. John might have seen this in El Salvador. He's highly intolerant also of human rights offenders and civil society organizations just like ours. He's what you would define typically as an authoritarian populist. He has discourse that where he claims to be connected with the people, yet he's very keen of the paraphernalia usually of power, surrounded usually by soldiers. The Economist just defined him perfectly a few days ago. He said that the Economist said that Bukele is an old-fashioned autocrat disguised as a tech-loving modern leader. And I tend to agree with this definition.
So, Paul, I want to ask you your views, Bukele, but I want to understand first, would you actually be considered in the administration? Is this me asking you about your boss?
Yeah, you are, actually. He in fact, gave me the role of president of CONAMIPE, which is the National Commission for Small and Micro Companies. I've been working with the president now for a number of years before he was elected president, with a view to helping him into power and obviously become the leader of what is actually a transformation of the nation. It's hard to talk about El Salvador in front of people around the world without putting things into context. I'll put the context in three statements. First of all, on the 15th of September in 1821, when the Declaration of Independence was written, the very first act, the very first article of the act says, having declared this independence, send this for publication before the people consider it as something of their own. And I think that puts something into perspective of where the country began in terms of democracy. It actually established a feudal system where we got rid of the king, but we actually transferred the feudal system from the Spanish to the Creoles. There's an organization in Washington called Global Financial Integrity, and their report for El Salvador for the years 2001 to 2015, they estimate approximately $20 million a year, over that period, left the state in corruption, evasion, money laundering, and illusion. And the result of that was the first multidimensional poverty measurement by the UN, where we had approximately 98% of all homes in El Salvador suffered at least one of 25 different dimensions of poverty. And to name just a few, 57% of homes suffered from unemployment or subemployment, 70% of homes had no access to Social Security, 45% of homes suffer from overcrowded households. I could continue, but I think that's plenty to put the context there. Mm-hmm. A transformation or a revolution, according to Erica Chenovez, who used to work for the Department of Justice, requires three things. One, it requires a cause, and the people united in a cause on the 3rd of February 2019, it needs a conviction to actually take action, and the people took action in 2019, and took it again.
I just want to jump in, because I don't think you can discuss El Salvador without talking about your homicide right there. You've gone from being the murder capital of the world to now it's less than Mexico. If we can go to my screen, I'm going to show a little graphic here.
Okay.
that shows the declining rate of murders. But I also happen to notice that the decline started in 2015. This was 4 years before he gets elected. So when he takes credit for this with his security plan, how do you justify the fact that, well, really, the greatest drops in this trend started years before he came into office?
The drops did start in 2016. 2015 was our most violent year ever. And it was when San Salvador was placed as the most violent capital in the world. And since then, it started dropping again. But we were still talking of a large percentage, 20-odd murders per day. And now that has been dropped dramatically over the last 2.5 years, with a view to getting to the point where there have been a lot of days where we've had zero homicides. That was unknown, unheard of before.
Well, let me ask you, is this because of a truce between the gangs?
I don't believe so. I believe that it is a direct result of having a better control of the territory. Before, the strategy was go in with the police and the military, make a big show, and then leave. So while they were there, the gangs left. But when the military left, they got back.
I want to chime in here.
Hey, Jose, jump in here.
I want to ask Paul if he then disregards entirely the newspaper investigations, the media exposure that an apparent truce has been revealed happening between the three primary gangs in El Salvador and the government. The evidence is mounting, Paul. So do you think this is just fake news?
Hey, guys, can I just throw into this? And this is for our viewers at home. We're going to tweet out a report right now. This is from the International Crisis Group. It's called Miracle or Mirage, Gangs and Plunging Violence in El Salvador. And there's a bite down here that says statistical studies show that the territorial control plan, which is his plan, is most likely not the sole cause. Specific local falls in murder rates do not correspond precisely to those areas where the plan's been implemented. Instead, in large part, gangs appear to themselves have decided to scale back the lethal violence. Paul?
I would hope that they have actually chosen to do that. But the truth of the matter is that...
But Jose was asking pretty specifically, does the government acknowledge that there's been a truce between the gangs as reported by the media?
The reports of some sort of agreement that has been reached with the gangs are based on people who are not necessarily known for reporting news, but for creating news. And I think that it's very difficult...
I'm sorry.
This is a well-respected outlet in El Salvador, and indeed in the region from El Faro. So just put that in a little bit of perspective.
Well, John, you bring up El Faro. The editor-in-chief of El Faro has been deported, right? Has he been expelled from the country?
One of his editors was deported by the same government. And this is the whole strategy, right? Discrediting, attacking the media, the journalists that do the investigation. And I can hear, I still haven't heard any response, serious response with evidence from the government discrediting the story from El Faro. The story has expanded in recent days. A newspaper just 2 days ago also revealed that one of the officials that El Faro identified as being part of the negotiations with the gangs was also meeting up with gang leaders at a hospital. So they would pull out gang leaders from the prison. They would take them as if they were sick to a hospital in El Salvador, and then they would meet with public officials to continue their conversations or negotiations or whatnot. I think it's pretty clear now, but not necessarily
any evidence of conversations. And I think it's very easy to jump to a conclusion, especially when you want to actually make a point in terms of your opinion of what's happening. I think the truth of the matter is, if you look at the ground, you look at the streets, and you go to different colonias, which is where people live, you see a big difference. You see a big difference. People are more open. I've had people tell me they're now able to...
Quick question for you on that one, Paul. Sorry, just exactly what you're saying, because that's what we did go when we were in...
I'm happy to answer your questions if you let me finish my point.
Front load your answers, Paul. But, John, you were just there in the streets. What did you find?
Yeah, we were talking to... This is my question for Paul. We were talking to people who... I think you saw it in that clip there, actually, Paul. Mm-hmm. We spoke to more people saying the same. We're really happy that violence has gone down, however which way that's happened, so we can go out at night. The follow-up question to him was, but does extortion still continue in your neighbourhood? And that's what we asked people there. Because it's what we found in the past in El Salvador, that violence has gone down, but the gangs are still operating. They've still got their businesses there. And we actually did see that happening when we're in that neighbourhood, that the gangs are still there and they're still operating.
Well, there's a report
I think, the question is, if they're still operating, if they're still extorting people in those neighbourhoods, do you think that's still happening? And if so, what's the government's plan to stop that then?
Listen, we have a Plan Control Territorial, which is nowhere near finished. It spent the whole year last year waiting for funds, which the Congress did not wish to provide. But what we have got is a tremendous advance. What we can see, and Ricardo Sosa is an investigative criminologist who has made a number of analyses. I provided Al Jazeera a copy of his latest report prior to this interview. And one of the things that it demonstrates is that it's not just homicides that have been reducing over the period, but also extortion, also thefts, and also female violence. So from that point of view, that's not the government stating it. It's a private analyst that's stating that. But the whole point, I think, here is that you can't just center a transformation of a country on just the situation.
Part of that transformation, Paul, is I got to jump ahead because we're running out of show really quickly. Part of that transformation has been accepting Bitcoin as the national currency there, or a national currency there. Here, I have a bit of video I want to share on that.
For the first time, a non-fiat currency becomes legal tender in a nation state. Around 23% of El Salvador's economy is remittances alone. Those remittances come specifically from the United States, and the legacy financial system is not fair to them. Now you could stay in the comfort of your own home and you could immediately receive a remittance in seconds, and the fee is minimal.
The adoption of Bitcoin as legal tender by the government of El Salvador serves primarily as a valuable distraction from the increasingly authoritarian measures being taken by President Nayib Bukele to consolidate power. And of course, as a cryptocurrency, Bitcoin has a highly volatile value. International actors have also expressed worry about this move. The International Monetary Fund, which is currently in negotiations with the government of El Salvador over a major loan, has expressed worry that it could be used as a vector for money laundering.
Jorge, how is this being seen there? I said Jorge, and I actually meant Jose.
Yeah, I think you said Jose.
I apologize, Jose.
No worries.
Our graphics guy here is Jorge on the show.
Don't worry. No, look, there's been a lot of hype about the adoption of Bitcoin as legal tender in El Salvador. I understand that. Mostly because the government has used its international publicity machinery to project an image of this making El Salvador prosperous and modern. And also the government has been also successful in mobilizing a part of the international crypto community. Mm-hmm. But I think the reality is very far from there. And I will give you three quick reasons. Look, the whole crypto Bitcoin adoption project has lacked transparency from the beginning. Did you know that the initial announcement of the adoption of a law that would make Bitcoin obligatory in El Salvador was made at a Bitcoin convention in the United States, long before the Salvadorians were informed about this fundamental change to their monetary policy? I think this reflects well on what I mean by lack of transparency. $200 million of government funds have already been used in this crypto project, and there is very little clarity on what the purpose of these funds would be, at least a big chunk of it. Bukele has said that the adoption of Bitcoin would make payments cheaper, and it would encourage foreign investment even. He has said this. There is, however, no evidence, no documentation from the government explaining how this will happen. A civil society organization requested just last week all technical documentation supporting the law, and none was provided because there is none, no technical evidence supporting the idea and the objectives behind the adoption of crypto as a legal currency. Second reason,
Hey, I want to give Paul a chance to jump in on this because we're running out of time. But Paul, sure. Doesn't this serve the part of the country? You got about half the country there has access to the internet, uses it regularly. Doesn't it serve them better than the other half that doesn't have access to the internet?
1.1 million businessmen invoice less than $2,400 a month, and 4.6 million Salvadorians depend on their sales to eat and live. More than 70% of the population has not got a bank account. And so from that point of view, the banks will not touch them because they're informal, because they don't have a credit track record. With Bitcoin, all they need is their national identification. And the advantage of that is that there's a very large proportion of them that receive remittances, as you heard in your report. This year, it's estimated that $7,000 million will arrive in El Salvador in the form of remittances. If you look at the average percentage of cost of remittances, you're talking of over $1,000 million if you take on board all types of remittance costs that will be saved. That money could come in extra income or could come in terms of investment by their relatives overseas. Additionally,
Paul, I find this really interesting, and this is a lot of numbers you're putting out. But why has the government failed to produce a single technical document to explain the linkage you're making between growth and opportunities for Salvadorans and the implementation, the forced implementation of Bitcoin as a legal tender? I still fail to comprehend that. Why hasn't the government produced a single piece of evidence? And what we have seen, on the contrary, is a campaign, a publicity campaign, for Salvadorians to adopt at the quickest pace possible this currency they do not fully understand, and which, by the way, is absolutely unpopular. It's extremely unpopular. Did you know that the only
unpopular such that half a million people have already subscribed in the last 7 days?
That is great.
That's the real statistic. The president announced it yesterday. Since the government wallet was launched in March 7th last week, we've had 7 days of about half a million people registering it. Now, the interesting thing about that is that by setting the wallet as a national wallet, the president can control all commissions on it. So that means that someone in New York can send $100 to his relative here in El Salvador, who will receive $100 and can transfer it to his bank account if he has one, zero commissions all the way through.
Hey, that middleman. That wallet, Paul, Chivo wallet, who owns that?
I'm sorry?
Who owns the Chivo, the wallet that you're talking about? Who owns it?
The wallet is a government-owned wallet.
And who's it run by?
It's run by a subsidiary, I believe,
It's a private company. It's a private company with stocks. Yes, it's a private company that has stocks and could be eventually sold out to somebody else. Yes, it was founded with government money, but it's a public company. You have to see this in the context of the democratic backsliding of El Salvador. So I have less than a minute, Jose.
So you got to make this point tight.
No, absolutely. Okay, so Bukele is immersed in this quick power grab. He has already eliminated the courts. He has the majority in the assembly. He's poised for re-election, undoubtedly. He wants to amend the constitution. He wants a new constitution. And now he wants us to believe that the new currency, the new legal currency, will benefit Salvadorians to whom he is now denying even the right
If you don't want to participate in Bitcoin, you don't have to.
Hey Paul, I hate to do it, but we have to end the show there. Paul, I want to thank you, Jose, and John. I want to thank all of you for being on the stream today, and I want to thank you for watching. Until next time, we'll see you in the stream.